Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. So check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, Sunset Lake CBD.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Osiris.
We'll talk offline, but first we'll talk online. Hey, everybody.
I was just trying to quote Barbie.
I understand. You did a good job. How's everybody doing? How's everything good. Going, guys?
Doing well.
We're good. We're
How are
good.
You guys?
Yeah.
Don't
tonight
ever
Tonight is a very important night. Can I tell you guys tonight is a very important night?
It's like tell a us.
Very, very why important is tonight night. Important, Brian?
Why?
Apologies in advance, Jonathan, but Goose is playing in Missoula, Montana.
Sports.
Sports. They have not played Huey Lewis yet. No, I'm sorry. But Goose is playing Missoula, Montana. And I personally just have a lot riding on this. This is my favorite place in the entire world. And the idea that these guys are eating at like the Bridge Pizza right now or Taco del Sol or God forbid the Shack. Please, Rick, Peter, if you're listening to this and you need breakfast, do not go to the Shack. Please just don't do it. It's always delayed and cold and it's awful. But like they're playing at the Kettle House Amphitheater outside Missoula. You can take a bus from my two favorite bars in Missoula to get to this venue. And it is like right at this bank in the Bitter River, just like 15 miles outside of town. It's absolutely gorgeous. I can't wait to webcast. And I just hope that they play a really good show. So that's what's happening right now.
That's how I felt like that when Goose played in Livingston and then like the Disco Biscuits played there. And that's like the place in Montana that I wanted to tell them to go. Like, here's all this, like the six places you have to go.
But then I didn't
tell anyone anything. Cause I was like, man,
those were great shows when they played Livingston.
It's a really cool spot. Yeah, Pine Creek Lodge.
Really good spot. Yeah.
How you guys doing? How's everything going? Everyone good?
Not bad.
Can I talk about something
that only I care about, maybe?
Yes.
Just real quick.
Please.
Because some people may not know that I have an album coming out in October, on October 6th. And you can find it on my Bandcamp, jmhart.bandcamp.com. And there's a couple singles that you can listen to now. One came out today. And yeah, please check it out. That's all. Thank you for allowing me to plug my things.
It's called So Below, if you didn't mention.
Oh, that's true. The album is called So Below.
That's the album title.
Such a good title.
Yeah.
I think there's more people that care about it than just you, Jonathan.
Quite.
Okay.
Definitely.
So everyone who's listening, give us, you know, check out Jonathan's music and then tell us that you checked it out so that we know that you're alive. Okay, so guys, we're in 2010. I feel like we we really haven't all been together for one of these in quite some time. So you're going to get the full treatment today. We are in 3.0. I said last week, I went to a lot of shows in 2009, and then I kind of stopped going to shows for a while. I didn't see very many in 2010 and 2011. I remember listening to like the Berkeley shows and probably some others, the show that we'll talk about today, but where was everyone on their fish journey in 2010?
I saw a bunch in 2009, and then I backed off a little, but I was still excited. I just think that the dates didn't line up for me the way they did in 2009. And I also didn't have a Hampton run that would give me a solid like block of three to add to whatever else I saw. But I was still excited. How about that?
I talked about a lot during our hiatus episodes that I had like a 48 or a 24 month period in time where I was just thinking about fish, and I wasn't listening to a lot of fish. I was listening to a lot of other music, and when the announcement came, I wasn't really on board with it. And I mean, still remember like Hampton, I was following those shows from afar, but there was no webcast. There was no couch tour of any kind at that point in time. It wasn't really until parts of June 2009 when I rejoined Fantasy Tour and people were couch touring shows. People were like holding out their cell phones and filming shows that like it all started coming back, and like the stats, the lore, there were a bunch of shows that like I just hadn't heard, had just like overlooked like full tours during kind of the height of my fandom in the early 2000s. And here we were 5 years later, and like the internet was so much better. I could just download just shows in mass quantity, and I was running through full tours I'd never really listened to. And I was learning a ton about the history of the band. And I felt like there were rabbit holes in 2009 and 2010 that I was learning about with fish that I just missed because of my age and because of when I came on the scene. And so in 2010, I was probably aside from like 2013, I was the most online about fish as I've ever been. I was on message boards constantly. I was talking with people all the time. There was a lot for me, like personally, just invested in this band. I was telling you guys in the thread yesterday, I looked at this almost like following like a sports team, that like every night there was, you know, essentially a game. Like every time that they were on tour, there was something to be excited about that night. And there was a lot riding on these shows. We're going to talk about it when we get into this show, but there were these like fits and spurts of moments of total brilliance and total connectedness, and like the ability to hear past versions of fish now at an older age. But there were also a lot of stretches where the band was clearly figuring things out and taking it kind of a one step forward, two steps back approach. There's a lot of vulnerability in their music. And so for me, I was totally invested, but also pretty aware that I was not seeing the peak version of this band and wondering if I was going to be able to ever see that again.
Yeah, I was at an interesting spot. I was like very much still with my young kids. I had my second daughter in January of 2010, and I went down to Raleigh, the show at Walnut Creek. Like those shows coincided right before our like beach vacation that we take in North Carolina with my family. And so I flew down with my 6-month-old and left my 6-month-old with my sister's friend at her apartment, and took my sister and all my college friends to our first, like my sister's first show, and all my college friends went. And it was like the first time I had like partied since I had my second daughter, and I went wild. And it was the first time I had like a smartphone or like a phone that I could take a picture with in the show. And so I found today a picture of me and my girlfriend from that show inside the show that I took on her phone. And the only reason I still have the photo is because it's like what I use for her contact, and it's kept over all these years. Yeah. Nice. So I still have it. Yeah. And so that's the only photo that I have from like so long ago of me like inside a show. I mean, there's very few of them. Wow. And it's so cool to think back that was then. And I remember that night, it was gorgeous out. It was so fun. We were in the lot. My friend grilled like pork, like tacos in the lot. And I was like, oh, this is how like adults legit fish. Like we're like fucking great. Like, we know how
can
we
you tell
do
me more
now
about the tacos? What
they
kind
were
of pork?
So good. So
like
my friend Kenny
butt, like cooked over the course of the
probably
day.
Well, I don't know. Yes, it was cooked before, or actually have a picture of Kenny making them. I can, okay. I will text yeah. to you guys. It's a picture of him on like a little grill. I think it
Reach
was
out
like
to small Kenny
chunks.
To send us the recipe though. We want to know about the marinade or rub, okay. what was involved.
I will. Yeah. It was super legit.
Do this tomorrow,
I think we
so
also
I need it as quickly as possible.
Okay, yeah. I can do that, guys. I'm on it. I mean, it depends if Kenny's going to write me back. We'll see if he's listening. But there's like pineapple. It was like it was real. It was really good. And I just remember thinking, this is just. And I kept running into all these people that I had like hadn't seen in so long since college, and I felt like it was the first time I tapped into that like what it was like to go to Fish when I was really young, and I was just so excited to be there. That show was. It was a great show. It wasn't like amazing, but it was super fun. They opened with llama because somebody had like a llama sign. You know, it was like the summer of signs. And like, it was just super fun. And
really
and
good light.
I remember, yeah, the light's beautiful, like really great jam. And then there's that like 10-minute encore of Boogie On, which is like one of my favorites. It was just so fun. And I remember dancing so hard all night and feeling like really young again for the first time since having kids. And it was kind of that moment when I remembered that I could go to this place and access these feelings again. And so it was really kind of like, I'll never forget that night. It was really memorable. So 2010 really stands out for me, but I was still only seeing them like once or twice a year at this point.
Yeah. I want to piggyback on Brian's comment about like the cell phone streams. So while I only went to a few shows, you know, I think I went to Camden and Meriwether. It's before I got over Meriwether. The cell phone streams were happening and they were terrible and we were definitely
horrible.
Still hanging on every bit of it.
Amazing. They're amazing.
Like the things we listened to. And then we'd get the Livefish download and we'd be like, this could sound better. Like what? It's such a massive upgrade from what I sat through listening through my laptop speakers or whatever, you know, on the night. And
you're bringing back like a really good memory. My brother and I, the night of Meriwether Night 2, found a stream and we were sitting on my parents' porch. Like my dad had made steak that night. I was back home from living in South Korea. My brother had just graduated college. We were like home for the summer before we went off and started to live our lives. And we found this shitty, shitty stream of the Meriwether Night 2 second set. And it's like the Sawed Again, Piper, Jumpin' Jack Flash second set. It's still one of the most enjoyable Fish experiences I've ever had. Listening to this like crackly set where like there's so much bass and there's so much like reverb in the room because someone's just like holding up a tiny little microphone. But oh my God, man, like we felt what was happening to you guys in Columbia, Maryland. And like that experience of understanding that you could be so far away, but hearing this live in the moment was just contagious. I mean, it's one of the reasons why webcasts continue to be one of my favorite things and one of my favorite ways to experience live music.
Yeah, I kind of feel like that Meriwether show that you're describing might be one of those, you know, never miss a Sunday show moments, because
I think it's the origin of it. In a lot of
it
ways.
Is
yeah.
because yeah. I did.
Wow.
I went to the Saturday show and I was like, I'm not dealing with getting home from Meriwether Post because I got to get up and go to work on Sunday morning. And so that happened. Yeah. Cause I went to the other night. I went to the first night. But man, what are you going to do? I did go like to Camden and Portsmouth prior to that. So, you know,
I think it was that show. It was Camden the summer before with the Big Sand. It was the Albany Seven Below Ghost, Alpine Night 2, 2009 was really good. All these Sunday night shows where it suddenly became this momentum of when Fish takes stage on a Sunday, magic is going to happen. It's going to be a lighter crowd, but it's really going to be the dedicated fans that are there. Not, you know, your Saturday Meriwether show had a really good rock and roll.
I mean, it was a fine and good show. I didn't complain about it at the time, and I won't now. But I will point out that I did not select it for our conversation today.
Did not.
Well,
no.
Well, now's the part in the show where we get directly into the show we're talking about. 10/20 to 2010. Just kidding. That's going to happen.
Yeah,
in like
we got all
minutes.
That context. So much
context. It's not how this works.
If you're just here for the Fish talk, come back in about 15 minutes.
Maybe 20 to be safe.
Yeah, maybe 5.
Should we take a ride to Meg's Corner to really understand what was going on with Fish in 2010, the year we made contact, if you will? Sorry, I won't make that joke any more than 3 times.
Yeah, let's go to Meg's Corner. Come on, guys. Come on over. It's nice over here. The year starts...
Sorry, that was bad white boy song.
There's the long, yeah, animated theme music.
There's nothing to thank me for that. That was horrible.
Yeah. I appreciate it since RJ stopped putting in my theme music. It's okay, but you did. You know, it's fine. Got lazy.
It's just an admin thing.
I know.
We lost an intern a couple of weeks ago, and yeah, we've got to hire a new one. You know, they'll go back and they'll backlog it so that everyone who's following this series in reverse will hear it.
In reverse. That would be a cool way to do this. Maybe somebody will.
Maybe.
The episodes will get shorter.
You think?
I think they may have, yeah.
Have they? Well, hopefully they'll get longer again. We can only hope. Well, this Meg's Corner won't take too long, hopefully. But in February, Trey is going to go on tour with Classic Tab. And Mike's going to go on tour in March. In March 2010, Trey is going to induct Genesis into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which is amazing. And the band's going to perform Watcher of the Skies and No Reply at All at the event. Did you want to say something, Jonathan?
Yes, because we need the band to bring Watcher in the Skies to the stage for the audience that didn't pay $1,500 a plate. Anyways, yeah, so that's all I got.
100%. 100% agree. Yeah, I totally agree. Unbelievable cover.
So fun. April 30th of that year, Phish is in 3D. They're going to put out the movie from Festival 8. On May 13th, Phish is going to be the musical guest on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon as part of the show's Rolling Stones Exile on Main Street Week. And so I didn't remember that this happened, but each night of the week, a different band covered a song from one of the Stones album. It's very cool. They're actually going to go back on June 9th as well and be on Jimmy Fallon again. And then on June 10th, 2010, which is kind of interesting, we were just talking about this, but they are going to launch the first version of the Live Phish app. So thinking about like how much I use that app, it's crazy thinking that it was 2010 that they put it out.
I completely forgot that that didn't exist in 2009. You had to download shows.
A website, like cavemen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like cavemen.
Cave people, excuse me.
There you go. They're going to play 48 shows in 2010. They're going to start with this pretty big summer tour. It's going to have 29 shows, but it's kind of split into two chunks. I do want to say that one of my favorite episodes that I listened to during the pandemic was the HF Pod 2010 summer kind of like look back that you guys did. It's pretty awesome that Jonathan and RJ, Jonathan looks surprised. Do you remember doing that, Jonathan?
Absolutely, I do.
RJ told me that this was the first historical overview series that HFPod has ever done. What is going on?
Nope. They did that. And it was really great. And
that was an episode.
You've got Brad, you've got Matt. Yeah, it's an episode. And it's awesome.
Episode. Come on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, before this, we always did, we covered shows in advance before they happened.
This is a real switch up.
I don't understand why this is confusing to anyone. Anyway, okay, keep going, Megan.
Yeah, carry on.
Then we don't have much more. There's a fall tour with 15 dates in like Austin City Limits, Colorado, Charleston. They're going to end in the Northeast, and they're going to do Halloween in Atlantic City, covering Little Feat's Waiting for Columbus. Mike is going to go tour in the fall and release an album called Moss. And of course, they're going to end the year in Worcester and MSG for the first time, playing on January 1st, but that's in the next year. And the MSG shows were available to stream for purchase. Yeah. And then they released a couple of first webcasts. It was the first one, right?
Excuse me.
Webcast in the 90s, my friend.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. There were those dial-up webcasts from Homedel, Vegas, Radio City, a couple others.
Dial-up. I had DSL. Company paid for it. It was awesome.
You lucky
definitely watched the Vegas one.
So lucky. But Brian, I want to know what was happening in the world in 2010.
The world in 2010, let me just present a caveat. If you vote for a political party based on a candidate and you like that political party and that candidate, you should show up and vote in the midterms, because if you don't, things like 2010 will happen. That's what was going on in the world in 2010. Don't ever fucking do that again, guys. Remember that for 2024, okay? Television-wise, though, We had some new prestige TV was expanding at this point in time. We had the first season of the show Tremé, which followed people in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. The Pacific, the companion series to Band of Brothers, focusing on the Pacific Front in World War II. Two of my favorite shows, Mad Men and Breaking Bad, were entering seasons 3 and 4. Boardwalk Empire launched David Chase's follow-up to The Sopranos, where in which we learned truly how sexy Steve Buscemi can be. The final season of a show that I did not watch, but apparently a lot of people watched, Lost, ended in 2010. I know that that was a huge deal. Another show I have never watched, but was a big deal, launched that year, The Walking Dead. We're seeing, like, at this point in time, if you look at, like, the, you know, top viewed shows on television, like on cable television at this point, they completely are different from what people are watching on, like, prestige HBO Showtime type of model. So it's like we're starting to see the split towards streaming that will launch in this decade. Movies, we've got Shutter Island with Leonardo DiCaprio, Martin Scorsese, really, like, wild psychological noir film, Greenberg, Noah Baumbach, Winner's Bone, the movie that introduced us to Jennifer Lawrence.
Oh, that movie's so good.
Amazing actress. Oh, it's unbelievable. Inception, the one of the most enjoyable movie theater experiences I've ever had. I still have no idea what is happening at the end of that movie, but I was just immerse me in dream world of Christopher Nolan. Easy A, the movie that gave us the first Emma Stone starring role. Amazing actor. The Town, Ben Affleck's gritty but ultimately disappointing ending portrayal of bank robbers in Boston.
It was pretty good.
My favorite.
Though.
It's
like great.
It's a really fun movie. It's just I can't get over the ending. The ending is too much. Let's just put a fucking bow on it. Everything's okay. Sorry to spoil it to you guys. There's some really good action. Really, really cool cop.
I think it's okay to spoil things at this point.
13 years on.
Exactly.
My favorite movie of the 2010s came out in early October 2010, called The Social Network. Jesse Eisenberg is one of my absolute favorite actors, and he blew this movie apart. And this, like, comments on social media and technology and community in such a fascinating way. Trent Reznor's soundtrack is unbelievable. The King's Speech won Best Picture, which proved once again the Oscars sometimes really suck. Natalie Portman won Best Actress for Black Swan. The Fighter came out, and Blue Valentine showed us that Ryan Gosling is, and I'm sorry, Meg, but he is he's probably the future of male acting in modern Hollywood.
Okay, I have to stop. Wait, listen, if you knew anything about me, I was like the hugest Ryan Gosling fan forever. He is quite possibly one of the most beautiful men on the planet, but I just felt like his performance in Barbie didn't match Margot Robbie's. That's all I'm saying.
I think
it wasn't
that's right.
The depth. It didn't have the depth.
I think you're right.
I mean, I haven't even seen the movie. I'm sorry. Job. Barbie outshines Ken no matter what, by default.
He's just.
I think that was the idea, though, Megan. Can we just say that was the idea?
Yeah, that was the idea. But I think that there were times I didn't believe him. There were just times I thought he was commenting on the role as opposed to, like, really living it.
I think that there's some accuracy to that. I think you're absolutely right about that. I think that there part of the way he was written was basically to say, this is Ken, and this is my view of being Ken versus like actually living it the way that Margot Robbie did. This will be
okay. That's
segment.
True.
Yeah,
that's an interesting point that maybe it was written to be commented upon.
Can we follow up on this next week? Because I'm definitely watching this weekend. I mean,
you need to watch this movie.
I mean, you have to.
I'm a busy man.
We are going
incredible.
To
I've seen it twice
hold
now.
This conversation for a year end, which will go through TV, music, and movies from 2023. Just finishing up here with music. Number one song in America. Anybody know what was going on in October 2010? Music?
Is it like
anybody have any
Drake
idea?
Or something? Drake was so popular, right?
Close. Take Care came out in 2010. It was Bruno Mars' Just the Way You Are, his first big, big song. A lot of really good albums this year, though. All right, so just bear with me. I'm just going to get the most controversial one out of the way first, okay? It's still a fucking awesome album, even though this person has ruined his entire credibility and everything about him in the years since. But it's Kanye West, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. Still my favorite running album of all time.
Not sure you were going to say something about Ryan Adams, but because the description applies.
Kanye's worse, I think, but...
Another artist that has ruined his credibility, and this was their last great album, Arcade Fire's The Suburbs. Getting into some friendlier stuff here, Janelle Monáe's The Archandroid came out. Loved that album. Mm-hmm. Joanna Newsom's Have One On Me. That is an immersive experience. Flying Lotus's Cosmogramma. I love everything that dude touches, and this was my introduction to his work. My two favorite albums of the year, The Nationals' High Violet and Deer Hunter's Halcyon Digest. There are still sounds on Halcyon Digest that I've never heard in any other place and have made me hear music completely differently, and that record sounds totally brand new and like it just raw experiment every time I listen to it. Jonathan, I know you commented on the last few times I've said stuff about Deer Hunter, so I do want to give you the microphone here.
Oh, no, it's fine. I think you cover it well. I do quite like that album. I like it. It's paired as a double on my LP release. Mm. Anyways, yeah, it's great. It's great stuff.
Really, really beautiful record. A few more. LCD Sound Systems, This Is Happening, their supposed final record. Really, really good stuff. Robin's Body Talk, Beach House's Teen Dream, Owen Trick's Point Never, Returnal, the first record I ever listened to from him. Titus Andronicus's The Monitor, Gil Scott-Heron's I'm New Here, The Walkman's Lisbon, Vampire Weekend's Contra, Emerald's Does It Look Like I'm Here, for all of you zone heads out there that want to hear some just like deep, deep fucking zones. Emerald's Does It Look Like I'm Here, Lower Den's Twin Hand Movement, Spoon's Transference, Sufjan Stevens' The Age of Ads, the famous record where Sufjan Stevens says fuck, How to Dress Well, Love Remains, Woods at Echo Lake, Tame Impala Inner Speaker, back when Tame Impala played guitar, Neil Young's.
Can I weigh in on please. This real quick? Okay, Woods at Echo Lake is probably one of my top from that year, but Inner Speaker is killer, and I just want to get the big time brag in that I ordered that record but from Australia and have an OG press of that. I saw Tame Impala when they played the Black Cat in Washington DC, tiny club, and the next time they came through they were in a much bigger club, and then now arenas and all that. It was awesome, and it has never been as good. Never been also, as good. I've seen them a number of times since. It's never been as good.
This record rules and made me think that we were hearing the future of indie rock in 2010, and Kevin Parker went on to do some different things. Yeah, a little different things. Neil Young's Lenoir, one of my favorite records, all reverb, drenched, Daniel Lenoir produced Neil Young. Cité's Dream Get Together, Girls' Broken Dreams Club EP. I was really sad I couldn't talk about Girls' album last week. And then finally, the triple EPs from James Blake, The Bell Sketch, CMYK, and Claverwork. Just amazing, amazing stuff. Really, really good year for music. This was also the first year that I started making a top albums list and have done it successively every year since then. So I was able to go through my iTunes library the way that it's ranked in order, which was quite fun to do and quite a nice trip down memory lane.
I think you mispronounced obsessively. I think you said successively. I think obsessively.
Obsessively. Very obsessively.
Jonathan, I'm just impressed that you were able to play the jaded music fan so quickly and seamlessly about Tame Impala. I mean, it's hard. It's great. Just such a great character.
We're going to obviously get to it in two episodes, but Jonathan, what are your thoughts on lonerism?
Okay. That's where they lost me. I mean, I like it's okay. It just didn't like blow me away like Inner Speaker or
interesting.
Yeah, I'm this big a fan, right here.
Not big,
right here, close to hand.
All right. I do so just want to say sorry. One last thing. Just one last thing.
Wow.
The day, 2 days before Phish played their summer tour opener in Chicago, the Blackhawks beat the Flyers, which led to an amazing experience where most of the fans brought inflatable Stanley Cups to the stadium and started throwing them on the stage. And someone threw a t-shirt that they had made that was Trey's face on the Chicago Blackhawks logo. Trey is a giant Philadelphia Flyers fan. And he held it up to the audience and he congratulated Chicago. Whoa. And he threw the Stanley Cups back in the audience. It was just a fun little gimmick and one of those kind of magical little fun fish meets pop culture moments that I love.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, listeners. I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com/VIP/helpingfriendly. That's DistroKid with a capital K, .com/VIP/helpingfriendly for a special offer. Thanks, DistroKid. And now, Jonathan, will you take us to...
Is there more? No. I mean, gosh.
We're going to Utica. We have to.
Okay, I've never been to Utica, but there is this fish show that happened there on 10-20-10. If you like weird number arrangements, that's one for you. Or 10-20-2010. Or if you want to alphabetize 2010-10-20, or we could stop talking about this and get to the show.
For a minute, 10-20-2010 is super amazing.
Yeah, right. Yeah, cool number.
Yeah.
So I picked this show because it's rad. This is one of the top rated shows for 2010. My feel for 2010 is that the pass that I gave the band for all of 2009, which was they're back, play whatever you want. It's not going to be perfect because they haven't played in so many years. That pass was beginning to expire. But at the same time, they were improving, but it was in little like fits and, you know, so it wasn't across every show. And so there are, if you let yourself get down, you'll find some low points in 2010. And there are high points. I saw a couple decent shows. I mentioned Camden earlier. That's got some good jamming. I didn't really want to get into that. And so I looked around and I found this one, which is, I think, one of the high points for the year. And if y'all want to make a case for any other show, I won't fight you. But this one has one of the things that I really love and one of the things that Fish was able to do well, even back in 2009, and we have it in the show that we covered last week, which is fun. They have so much fun, especially in this first set. The jams do not get deep, but they get interesting. And that's why I picked it. And shall I read the first set? Do you guys want to fight me about
this? I just
want to
say the second set rules, please. Too.
I'm not knocking the second set, but we call it Gaiutica because of the first set. And just so everybody knows, here's what the first set is. It opens with My Soul, which is ripping, and RJ loves it. Stealing Time from the Faulty Plan, Vultures, Wolfman's Brother, Into Cities, and the Gaiuti. Then David Bowie, which is a big feature on this set. It's nice to have a Wilson, Into McGrup, Saw It Again, Into Antelope. That is kind of a packed first set. What did you guys think?
Well, I think one of the points you made, I think everything you said was really accurate. Like, this was a period where I remember online, there was a lot of that tension between the people that were holding out hope that, like, these moments where the band would really connect were proof that them coming back meant that they were trying to recreate something new, and other moments where there were accusations at this time being thrown around that the band was a nostalgia act. I never personally bought into that accusation, but it was being thrown around at the time because of those one step forward, two step back type of moments. What you keyed in on, Jonathan, though, was something that really carried the band, I think, up until basically Super Bowl, which was humor was the way into the magic with Phish. And this show totally has it. This show, my immediate memory of this show, for whatever reason, I could not find a stream this night, and I was just refreshing the set list on Fantasy Tour. And with every set list refresh, like 45 new threads would be created on the Fantasy Tour forum of people just losing their goddamn mind. Because, and as I was listening back to this, like, this show sounds slightly tame to today's standards just because of what we're used to from, like, any song can be played at any point in time. Jams go really deep wherever. This shit did not happen. Like, the Wolfman's in the Cities, that did not happen. The David Bowie that has elements of Gaiuti and Wilson, and then they play Wilson and that has elements of Gaiuti. The Saw It Again that has a jam. McGrupp just being fucking thrown into the middle of the first set just because, hey, this is how you all know that you're at a classic show. This shit didn't happen. And people were losing their goddamn minds. And part of it was the night before they did a Fuck Your Face Mike song mashup. And so, like, it was... They're in the Northeast. It's October. They're in small college basketball gyms, and they're segueing in and out of some of their most famous songs. This shit at the moment felt like a throwback to 1994 and 1995. And for people like myself, it was the first time I'd ever seen anything like this, and we were losing our minds.
Good perspective.
So that's what I thought of it.
I think...
RJ.
No, go ahead, Megan.
You can go ahead, RJ. I'll go to you.
I mean, with despite a horrible opener, the set is great.
Yeah, I mean, you can hate this song, you do, but this is a hot rocking version of the song. Trey is doing his damnedest to rock out.
Yeah, on this he's song. Trying to make the song good, which he always does.
He doesn't ever play the song bad. It's just not a good song.
I would be shocked if Trey didn't know how to play 12 bar blues. Let's just be honest.
And he slays it. Come on.
I think that if you're listening to this show, you wouldn't necessarily think it's a 2010 show, you know, from the first, like, the Stealing Time and the Vultures, and then the Wolfman's with this great vocal jam where they're just clearly all having fun. It sounds more like a 2012, 2013 show than a 2010 yeah. show in my opinion. And I think there's, you know, the Gaiuti is fun, but, like, even like the Bowie and the Wilson, I don't really know, like, what song they're playing or how to, like, you know, there's so much going on. It's really confusing in a good way, and then suddenly they're, like, back and playing Gaiuti again, and then Wilson, and then they're playing Bowie, but really Wilson, and they actually play Wilson and the McGrupp. I mean, it's just, and the Antelope to close the set is a really well done version. It's a really fun set, a lot of fun, and I think probably the best show that they played this year, although there are probably segments of other shows that are as good, but, like, this is just it's a great show. Like, especially this set is just awesome.
Yeah. I think that's what it reminded me a lot of 2009, the show we talked about last week, just, like, how much fun they're having. They sound super loose. They sound playful. They sound relaxed. And I think that they're doing stuff that would blow us away today. I mean, the stuff when they're doing between, like, the Wilson and the Bowie, how they do the, like, lead up to Wilson and then drop back into Bowie. And, like, they're using, like, the riffs from either song on top of each other. And it's just, like, mm-hmm. the dexterity that takes is crazy. And they're doing it, they're having so much fun. And when Trey's, like, singing, like, the lines from Gaiuti in Bowie and in Wilson, I mean, it's just, like, it's so playful. It's like a throwback to the early 90s in a way that just feels Like, it must have been crazy to be in the room and just be like, what is actually happening right now? I just feel like it's just so much fun to listen to. I think they sound like really tapped in and they're just like listening to each other and having such a great time. It's awesome to watch the YouTube videos of this because they're just like, Trey just looks like he has like a huge smile on his face the whole entire set. He just looks like he's having an absolute blast. And I think that for them to come out and then play the set they do for set two is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean, this show, you talk about the YouTube videos, this show was released officially on DVD, not along with, but right after they released Alpine 2010 as well. Both of those shows were released officially on DVD. And it was just kind of a clear sign of like where the band saw their peak periods in the tour or in the year. And, you know, that Alpine show has a fantastic Down with Disease, a really strong first set. This show showed kind of the counter to that, where there's no super deep jams, but like where they find that looseness that we now get from a Carini that opens a show and goes for 20 minutes or a pretty, you know, a beautiful like 45 segment, you know, in the second set with like three or four songs segued together. You got that here in the band kind of tapping into that like gimmickry and that humor that really defined them as we talked through the 1980s when not as many people were paying attention and they were a college band. There wasn't as much on the line. It felt like they were tapping back into that energy here.
Yeah. I mean, they're just fucking around, if you'll excuse the expression. You know, I feel like the show is on track to be a normal to decent show until Gaiuti, and they play Gaiuti, and I think Gaiuti goes really well, and I feel comfortable saying that on any given night in 2010 Gaiuti could have not gone really well, but mm-hmm. it did. And I think they must have been feeling it. The audience was giving it back to them because they start David Bowie and then Trey just doesn't want to let go of Gaiuti. He's just happy about Gaiuti and the pig, and you hear it in the intro, and then they get through the song, they get down to the part where they might jam, and you know, and he's playing the dudunts part and the audience is with it. They immediately like, oh, we're doing Wilson now.
Yeah.
And they're right there on top of that, and that was so fun. There's also an It's Ice Tea somewhere in there. I don't remember where that was, but you know, they're just having so much fun and like fluidly moving around, and Trey is transposing Gaiuti onto every tune after they play Gaiuti throughout this set. Just an absolute blast. This is the kind of ridiculous good times fish that I'm always on board for. And so that that just smokes.
I just wanted to put up this quote from Incredible Perp, because he said he was talking with his friends at the show about how prominent Page's sound had become in 3.0, and it was very noticeable. And I noticed that at the show that I saw in 2010 too. Page just sounded incredible.
Yeah, I remember there was a lot of talk coming out of like Hampton 09 that he was the strongest, like his performance was the strongest during that period. He had gotten, I feel like, an additional keyboard or additional synthesizer at that point in time. I was really leaning into it in certain parts. He got the keytar in summer 09. He just was stepping out a lot of ways. This was around the period where Page briefly became the spokesman for the band and would welcome everybody to the concert. He was just like very much taking like more of like a front and center role in the band, both improvisationally. And I mean, oftentimes, you know, whenever Trey would kind of, you know, he didn't have, that clarity that we get right now in a lot of his lines, where like it's very lyrical what he's playing, but it's also like fully thought out. You didn't get that as much then. It was a lot more like washes of sound from Trey, and oftentimes what Page would do would lead where the jams would go. And it was really cool to hear, and kind of listening to this type of stuff in succession with what we were listening to of the side projects during the hiatus really mm-hmm. kind of showcases, because we talked a lot about how strong Page sounded in that 07 show. Only 3 years later, like Fish is the main project for all of these guys again. They haven't really, like, they are still figuring out who they are in conjunction with where Fish is at, and Page was at such a high level at that point in time musically.
I want to say...
Yeah, and out of the... I'll just say this quickly, Jonathan. Out of the six debuts that were original this year, Halfway to the Moon is the only one that's hung around.
God, I love that song.
Which is so interesting.
I want to say that this might be around the time when Mike would start demurring when people want to interview him about Phish when he's getting ready to do a solo tour. This might have been around the time when Mike was like, well, you know, yeah, I still do Phish, but I am also, you know, I am this, you know, which is interesting. That's like, you know, me, I don't know. Is it like me saying, well, I mean, I also work on computers, but I'm a podcaster, you know? I don't know. Come on, Mike. But I feel like Mike's recommitted, but definitely Paige, just from before the beginning, Paige was ready in Hampton 09. Paige came out and he knew all his stuff. I don't know if he kept secret charts aside that he could practice, because I do know that there were songs that they had to learn from tapes or CDs or whatever, iPods or something. But he was always, he was ready and remains to this day. Do we want to get into set two?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
So set two starts very early aughts with Drowned into Sand, Theme from the Bottom, Axilla into Birds, Tila into Split Open and Melt, into Have Mercy, into Piper, into Split Open and Melt, into Slave to the Traffic Light. And the encore is Good Times, Bad Times. Yeah, you're right, Megan. This second set is strong. It's really strong, particularly that's, you know, the latter half of it. But the first part's pretty good too. Tell us your thoughts on it.
And Sand gets really funky. It sounds effortless. I love how it kind of deteriorates and theme kind of like emerges out of it. This is the wrong Axilla, but it still has really great energy. And I like Axilla and Birds.
At the time, like, it felt like the only Axilla.
It felt like the only one, but it's the wrong one. But I love like Axilla and Birds like in this spot. It's like keeps the energy going. You know, Birds has like a nice little like type one peak. And then Tila just like, okay, we're just going to play Tila because we played McGrupp too. And like, everybody's like, this is the best ever. But then this whole like Split Open and Melt sandwich that you've got here is awesome. It's so beautiful. This Split Open and Melt gets so dreamy. And then Trey just like, I haven't listened to this since 2010 and I kind of forgot what happened. And like when Trey starts singing Have Mercy really slowly, it's so beautiful. It's breathtaking. Paige joins in. It's just really, really gorgeous. This jam is amazing. And then the flow into Piper just seems totally inevitable. It's like you knew it was going to happen. It's just, it's so great. And even though Piper's really fast, you know, the intro is really, really fast. It gets pretty like trippy. They're quoting Birds of a Feather. It gets like swirly and psychedelic. And then you hear Fishman start playing Split Open and Melt again, and they're just like, they're back in it. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, I looked it up. Jonathan's right. A very familiar opening to the set too. Drowned opened 7 second sets in 2009 and 2010. It has opened 14 total in 3.0, 4.0 era, the last being 7:30 2017, which is a very good version of Drowned if you haven't heard that. But this was like peak period where it was like you could bet on either Drowned or Rock and Roll opening a second set, and you were more often than not right. That Plinko jamming in Sand that kind of, you know, preview is what we'll get out of, I think it's either the Sand or the Runaway Gym from the MSG show. There's this great Plinko jam in the New Year's Eve show that will kind of like carry over into summer 2011. To your point, Meg, like the Split Open and Melt, Have Mercy, Piper, Split Open and Melt, this is more of that throwback to 94, 95 type of vibe. And it really is fitting that we're in like a Rust Belt town in, you know, Western New York on a damp October night, just listening to this band, like, you know, mess around as though they're playing in a college with, you know, people just traveling around and no press, no kind of like pressure on them at that point in time. My thought when the, because I hadn't listened to this in a long time either. And I listened to this a ton when it came out. I listened to this a ton during that era. the intro to Have Mercy reminds me a lot of the O Holy Night from Holes Night in the Baker's Dozen.
Yeah.
And it just has that kind of like creepy beauty that they tap into during that, where it shouldn't get this quiet or this pretty at a rock show, but there's also like this weird dissonant space behind them. And it just, it sounds very eerie. I mean, that is 94 Fish to me. Like that sort of, everything shuts off. There's like weird sirens going on. And then they come in with something very pretty and almost, you know, childlike. Like the melody to Have Mercy sounds like something that you've heard a thousand times, even if it's the first time you've heard it. And I just like kept thinking, listening back to this, like this didn't happen. Like they did not drop into this sort of musical space in a rare song out of the middle of another jam and then go into a different jam song. And then back, like these sandwiches did not happen during this period in time. It was so exciting to hear it in the moment. And going back to it, it just makes me think about like the foundational steps that this band followed in early 3.0 to ultimately get to where they are today. And there's still constant evolution and constant learning. But like you hear them at this point in time, they're only 75 to 80 shows into the return. They're only 18 months into this project being back. You know, for Trey, from a personal standpoint, he's still very close to everything that happened. For these guys, like every single show is kind of a, is this still going to work thing? And to think about this show in context with the Fuck Your Face show from just under 2 years later, Magna Ball, the Baker's Dozen, like you can hear the building blocks towards that band ultimately, by playing shows like this, by taking risks like this, by having moments that really excited people, both listening and I have to imagine excited them on stage.
Good.
I mean, I like that they left the Gaiuti thing in the first set and just, and like,
totally,
you know, started fresh in the second set. And this a totally different show, really. I mean, it makes a whole show, but it's just a different kind of approach with much more improv. And it just shows a looseness, like you guys have said. I mean, I think looking back on it now, I don't know if I knew this at the time, but it feels like 2010, like they kind of got a, 2009 was a little bit intense, I think, because it was, there was like, there was, everything was coming back, like you were saying, Brian, but it's also like, I don't know. I think at this point, what I hear in this show is just like, they're grateful that they're playing in front of people, but I also just feel like they are back to being like, we're just going to do whatever and the fans are going to be fine and it's going to work. Which I think 2009 was a little bit hit or miss in that way. They just feel very comfortable. And it just, some of this jamming is really, is pretty organic and really, really cool.
2009 felt a lot like a service, like what you're talking about, where it was a lot, they knew a lot of people were coming back to seeing the band for the first time. Like every show that they played, there was a chance that a certain population of the crowd was seeing them for the first time since 2.0 or since the 90s. This felt like, this tour specifically felt like structurally the location of where the shows were, that the band was allowing themselves to just kind of play without pressure and play kind of just as themselves. And as a result, you got just a lot of hijinks. You got a lot of creativity. You got a lot of intra-band communication, even though the jams aren't going super long or super deep. There's a lot happening within the music at this point in time.
Yeah, this, I want to speak to what happened in the second set a little bit myself before we get on to like final overview takeaways or whatever, because I do enjoy the Drowned Sand intro, you know, set opener combo. It's pretty dynamic. We get a little of that Plinko. I love the Tila after Birds of a Feather. Speaking of Paige, sounds beautiful there. And then the call to go to melt is just, Fish just hits the end of the drum beat. I'm sure Trey probably was like, melt or whatever, however he called it. But anyways, Fish starts it up and I'm just like, yes. Driving in my car, I listened to this the other day. I was just like, yeah. And a thing I do, and I don't know if you guys do this, but when I go back and listen to these shows for this or a lot of things, you know, I might look at the set list before I hit play, but then I'm not looking at it while I'm listening. So I kind of forget what's coming and I don't know the sequence. And like, I know there's a Piper there somewhere, but When they slid into Have Mercy, I was just, I was kind of floored. This is gorgeous. Yes, this is how Have Mercy is supposed to appear anyways. And when it does, it's just glorious. And then, yeah, I am going to probably stop complaining about Pipers that don't slow build in the current era, because this last one last week and this week, yeah, when they build like a punch in the face is, you know, this is better. We're in a better place now. But the Piper
slammed into it here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It pays off, goes back into melt, which takes us into, I think, a pretty lovely finish on Slave. And I think, I don't know if it's consensus, but I think most people agree that when Fish plays Good Times, Bad Times, it's either this show's been a slop fest, but we enjoyed it, or this show's ripped and it's been fun. It's somewhere
either good times or bad times.
Yeah. And I think this is the latter one. I think they walked off having had a great time, and I know the audience did, and I did at home just now.
I think, Jonathan, just on that, Slave, I heard like some really awesome interplay between Trey and Mike in that jam. That was like,
yeah,
really nice. Maybe that happens a lot in Slave and I just don't notice, but it stuck out to me for sure.
I mean, I think it's one of the main components of Slave that the mic is definitely taking some kind of semi-lead stance or playing off of Trey's lead. But that reminded me that, you know, it's easy to listen to this show and just give all the credit to Trey for fucking around with Gaiuti in the first set, but there is definitely some bits where I heard Mike teasing the Gaiuti melody later after the song. And so shout out, like everybody was in on the gag, I guess. So it's fun to hear.
There was some nice symmetry between closing this show with Led Zeppelin and closing last week's show with the Beatles. At some point, the only thing to do in the encore, you know, you're going to play a 90-minute first set, an 80-minute second set. You have time for one song. Just play to your idols, you know, play to your heroes, and just let that kind of speak to the level of musicianship.
Well, plus, aren't we in a run-up to a Halloween where nobody knows what they're going to play?
So good point.
Every cover is like taken as, oh, dude, they're gonna play Zeppelin this year, you know,
which they would fuck around with on 10:30. That's one of the shows that has like you know, it kind of feels like a cousin of this show with the
who's on the list,
Chalk Dust, a Whole Lot of Love, Chalk Dust, and then the second set that's got a whole Zeppelin mashup. There was kind of a sense during that period that Zeppelin was finally going to happen. I think Waiting for Columbus was probably the right pick though, because that was a really good, Halloween performance.
Waiting for Columbus. And then RJ's making a face. We should talk about that as we talk about Halloween just a tiny bit, because I mean, Little Feat is a band that clearly informs Fish.
Yeah.
Bill Payne is a player, definitely informed, particularly younger Paige. That's why, you know, when I missed the Paige McConnell, the 2007 episode, I knew that he would be okay with me missing his episode because I was going to see Little Feat that night.
He approved.
Yeah,
he did. Exactly. He told us.
And I think that was a great pick. I know it is not high on the audience ratings, but that's too bad. I love the album. I enjoy Fish's performance of it. And Bill Payne was really stoked that they did it when I talked to him on Broke Down Pod. So
that's awesome. Good. I'm glad. I mean, I think it's fun. But I'm glad that all that stuff happened for you and to you, Jonathan.
So does anybody else have any takeaways on this?
I just really wanted to see. I just really wanted to see Fish cover Led Zeppelin. I mean, how fucking hard is that?
Yeah.
You know,
you have. Surely you have seen them cover some Led Zeppelin.
Not all of Physical Graffiti. It's like my one Halloween.
At the end
thing,
of this series, we are going to get into our specific gripes and desires.
Yes,
that's my only
episode.
Be fulfilled.
It's literally my only one. That and Possum, and my soul being played too much.
I just want to play Possum so they don't have to do any other Skynyrd covers.
I just want to give a quick shout out to a couple additional moments from this year, because as we've noted, there are a lot of that hits and misses, but this tour specifically, if you out there are not familiar with it, if you enjoy this show, I'm sure that most people have heard this show. I'd recommend checking out 1016 set two, 1019 set two, specifically The Light, my favorite jam of 2010, and 1026, which Fish utilized as a dinner movie during the COVID period, which has a ton of bust outs in it, a really good version of Light as well. And then technically not 2010, but part of the 2010 New Year's run, the 1111 show. Did I get that all right?
Oh, November, I was at that show.
Numbers. Doesn't count, January, but we'll 1st, let you talk about it because of all the cool numbers.
Very cool numbers, really good show, great vibe. The band had never played a New Year's Day show before, as Megan noted, and it just like, it had that kind of exhausted, but like kind of blissful New Year's Day type of feel where the party was the night before. We're all getting together. It's a little chill, but it's like you're hanging with the really good people because of the people you can hang out with in sweatpants and eat queso at 2 o'clock in the afternoon while watching college football. That was the vibe of this show. Really,
it was
good.
Not
really
show for show. Me. It was not show for me. It's not a chill night for me.
We will hear about that in the 2011. Yeah, I got to do this.
I was there. I was there also, Megan.
Something crazy happened. I wish we were there together, RJ.
What were your grievances from that show, RJ?
None. It was great. I mean, it was a novelty. Actually, do you want... I've told you guys the story about the guy in front of us during that show who... Okay, this is a very quick story, I promise. There was a guy in front of us who I was with Rachel and our friend Mary, and... the guy in front of us was tripping and basically like was convinced that he couldn't get out of the seat. Like the seat had closed, you know, on his leg. And like anyone who's like not tripping, like you can get out of those easily. You know, even if you have like a weird shaped foot or the seat is like they're designed to not be. So the problem was this happened to him during the Reba jam. And it was like,
oh no.
It would at first Rachel tried to like help him, you know, cause that's what she does. And he's like, thank you. And then, and anyway, it went on for like 15 minutes. The security had to come down and there were a bunch of guys with flashlights. They unscrewed the seat and
oh my God, that's outrageous.
Like, ultimately carried this guy out because he was still, then he was convinced.
One seat attached?
I hope so.
No, they detached the seat, but he was convinced that he couldn't move. And he ended up telling Rachel she was the devil. And like all that happened during Reba, which was just like not great, you know, like during, not you know, cool. If it was during Round Room or something, like, that's fine. But man, it was so weird. And we were just, I mean, we didn't, you know, we weren't upset. We were concerned for him, but
that was, you've been there. You get it. You're empathetic.
I mean, not that far.
No, that's very confused. I just want to know what the security Rachel. Said over the radio. Like, hey, we need a drill down here. This guy thinks his leg is caught in the chair.
Yeah, I think
security thought he was stuck because I think maybe they weren't like, they didn't think what I thought, which is like, all right, obviously this guy's like,
he's on tons
of drugs. Way too many drugs. I think they were like, we have a situation. Anyway,
you guys don't have to worry. He just took too many drugs. It's okay.
Was that you, Megan?
I have to decide. No, I was kind of close to that. I have to decide if I'm going to publicly tell this story. I have to decide if I'm going to tell this story in public because it is so embarrassing. So I'm going to think about it. I'll let you know next week.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah. I do just want to, since we're sharing drug-related anecdotes, I'd like to share a drug-related anecdote from the days when I took a lot of drugs. I was at Deer Creek with my wife and a bunch of our best friends and my brother. And my brother had lawn tickets and I had pavilion tickets. And we split up our drugs, ate them very quickly, and the line going in like too quickly because they all kind of hit like very – like immediately. And – a couple songs in the show, I was like, shit, I got to get my brother down to our seats. And I swear to you, I turned around and looked at this like sea of people on the lawn. And it was like the entire world split apart. And I just saw my brother like in this goofy ass purple t-shirt and his pink sunglasses with this giant smile on his face, just dancing. And I grabbed my wife's ticket, like pushed people aside, like beelined right for him, grabbed him, pulled him down to our seat. We had a great show. Second set was super wild and coming out of Dogface Boy, he just turns to me and goes, "Hood." And like 2 seconds later, Fishman goes, "Ba-da-ba, ba-da-ba-ba." And like, I looked at him like he could just like see the future. And I gave him this giant hug and started crying into him. And it was like still one of my favorite Harry Hoods ever, even though it's like 9.5 minutes and pretty unremarkable. Like, you cannot tell me that that is not one of the best Harry Hoods they've ever played.
That's awesome.
I wish we had done these stories earlier in the show, but I hope people are still listening. And yeah. And if you are still listening, thank you. And also, I should have said earlier, Mike Gordon did an interview with Rhett Miller this week on Rhett Miller's podcast, which is called Wheels Off. And you all should check it out. It's a great conversation about all kinds of stuff. Mike is a good, he's a good interview. He's done a couple recently. So you should check that out. Is there anything else we need to tell people besides we'll be back next week?
We'll be back next week. 2011 yeah. Fish.
You know, maybe subscribe to Osiris Premium.
Yes.
We're going to do some more bonus episodes. Mm-hmm. RJ and I have a date tomorrow.
We do.
To do some recording. And there's all kinds of content. And I don't know what else you get when you do it. But RJ can tell you right
many things.
Now.
Many things.
So many
ad
things.
Ad-free bonus content and supporting what we do. Thanks, Jonathan. Sure. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Megan. Thanks, Brian.
Bye, y'all.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Osiris.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Mo, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.